Brendan Thompson. Yeah.
Hello. That was a hell of an introduction. Frankly, I'm already disappointed, aren't you? I'll begin at the beginning of time. One million years BC. The oceans were hot and spat toothy fish into the air like olive pits. Mountains drooled fluorescent paint, valleys filled with loose change and lost sunglasses. In the jungles, great lizards walked on 2 feet, carried flasks of warm lava, and lied and lied and lied. The trees had crude tattoos and dropped suitcases full of money on the ground. Cats with knives for teeth stalked themselves under skies crowded with sharp birds calling, "Oh! Baby!" At night, nothing walked. The moon hissed at the ocean, and the stars held each other at gunpoint. That is a poem based on what I heard when they told me about dinosaurs. It wasn't actually what they were trying to tell me, and the theme of this evening will probably be misinterpretation. This is a little more lyric, and it's just as short. This is Ghost Magical. Girls walk together down the leaf-brown street in time to some song they know. They walk into winter like a neighborhood. The songs about love, how they wait for it to call, come dancing. There's also a lyric about the length of night. The words are hard to follow. The girls are laughing now because the song is so silly or innocent or old. It's cold. Their laughter breaks behind them. They must live around here, or they're ghosts and they used to. Only the dead are so brazen, so used to a place. One waves to a face in a passing car. It doesn't stop. Ghosts they are. What of the leaves, the street, the cones of orange light that pulse as the girls go? What of it? Come dancing, my love, come dancing. The night is too long without dancing.
Thank you. So, I have the peculiar job of teaching poetry back home. And, are there any teachers in the house? Is there anybody else that teaches? Or is there anyone who works with children? Have you perhaps seen a child in a museum? You know what I'm talking about. Okay. Yeah. And, do you ever have that experience though, where you're explaining something to a child and you say, "Do you understand?" And they say, "Yes." And then you think, I need to ask some follow-up questions. I'm not sure what they're getting. And this is about that experience. This is called Meeting the Authors. I'm talking to the children about strangers. They're people your parents haven't met, I say. They're everywhere. Now I want to know what the children know. What does a stranger look like? It's a man, they say. My fault, perhaps, I've been saying he all day, but like mice, they've gathered bright things from who knows where. He's tall, has a beard, brown eyes with gold flecks, a long coat. His pockets are full of candy and broken glass. He has toys, which he makes himself or inherits from the children who speak to him. If you go with him, he will keep you. The stranger has no name, no name. You don't call him, you draw him out by being alone or not looking at clocks, by making up what you haven't been told. I've been trying that now from school to school, actually. It's come up, and I found that it's been an interesting icebreaker with kids, is just asking them, what does a stranger look like? You'd be amazed to discover, apparently, there are commonalities all over the place. I just worked with some kids from Hong Kong, and they echoed something that some kids in Los Angeles were saying, that strangers all drive white vans. Did you know? They all have white vans. So did I hear yes? Everybody said yes, absolutely. Yes, certainly this. I guess they give them to you when you decide to be a stranger. I don't know how that works. But so, okay. And this is a poem that just got into a little magazine. I was really pleased. I didn't know if it was going to have a future. You know, you write these things, and then they sort of stare at you from the desk, or you know, and you know, like they're crashing on your couch. You know, and you sort of have to say to the poem, "Okay, you need to go get a job now. You need to leave and go get into a magazine or something." So this is about the neighbors. They left their dog and a record playing. They left their dog and a record playing, the boy and the girl next door. Last night, they argued to music like they do. This morning, only the song was home. A dog asleep in the yard, the yellow dog, the mortified, raving yard. The girl wore an egg of amber on a chain around her neck. The egg bore a black widow spider, its hourglass brown as bourbon, the sand run out for good for the whole neighborhood. How they got so much in that little car, we'll never know. How they got so much, they couldn't agree. It was what they fought about, and the dog, the record playing. The boy wore a wallet with a chain to his belt. The wallet bore a skull with smiling eyes, the word misfits worn away with pain. The door is open, skull dark. We don't need to go to know it's empty, to see the player on its milk crate, playing the record over, filling the house, spilling the dog outside like an oath, a vow left to keep itself. I'm going to get a little darker, and then I'll truck right out of it. This is new. I think this might be the first audience for this poem. And there's an American poet named Maxine Cumin who was interviewed a while back, and they asked, how long have you been a poet? And she said, public or private? Those are two very different things, you know. This one wasn't going to go public, but then it did. The needs of the many. Oh, and I guess the only other thing I'll tell you about this, I don't think William Carlos Williams said you should never explain a poem, but it always helps. There's nothing that really needs to be explained in here, because I'm paranoid, I'm going to clarify one thing. It always seemed to me when I was in hospital waiting rooms, they would always have paintings by Paul Klee. I don't know why it is, but like if it wasn't for hospital waiting rooms, he wouldn't have half the exposure he got. So anyways, there'll be a reference to that. And so now you know why I said that. The needs of the many. On the days when we wept, and there were many, we did it over the sound of a television or radio, or the many engines of the sky. It was rarely so quiet we could hear just our sadness, the smallness of it, that is merely the sound of wind and water between the many pages of the lungs. Many afternoons we left the house still crying and drove to a cafe or the movies or back to the hospital where we sat dumb under the many eyes of Paul Clay. There were many umbrellas, days when it refused to rain, cups of tea ignored. We washed them all in the sink, dry-eyed. It's been a while. We're cried out. We collect pauses and have taken to reading actual books again. We go through them like yellow lights, like tunnels or reunions. We forget which. The older you are, the more similes, the more pangs per hour. Indeed, this is how we break 1 hour into many, how healing wounds time in return. And though we know there will always be crying to do, just as there's always that song, always a leaf somewhere in the car, this may be the only sweetness left, to have a few griefs we cherish against the others, which are many. So, my father's here with me tonight, and I get to tease him in front of you, and it's weird talking about you in the third person when you're right here, so I'm going to talk to you. But the thing that I sometimes share is I come from a family of actors, and I think it was sort of assumed that I was going to be an actor, and then we had that conversation that one day, and I said, you know, I don't think I'm going to be an actor. And Pop said, oh, thank God, mother of, you won't know the rejection, the heartache, the inflated expectations. I said, no, I'm a poet. He went, oh, Jesus! Like, you know, how did you find something worse than acting? Are you out of your mind? And certainly, now, my family's been incredibly supportive of what I do, and they are my loudest cheering section. But certainly there is, you would imagine, cause for alarm if your child says, no, not doctor, not lawyer, I'm going to make a living looking for similes. I'm gonna make a living, you know, empathizing with things, you know, really, you know. And I think that poets are allowed to address absolutely any subject. I think we can go after anything. There's no forbidden subject. If there's anything that I feel that I have to be careful about, is that while I'm running around looking for things to feel with, if I'm not careful, I can cross a line between between appreciation and appropriate, and that can happen rather innocently, you know, where you suddenly cross into territory, and though there's nothing that you can't write about, you may, without knowing it, start writing about something in a way that is not necessarily yours to do, that you might be taking something from somebody else. And I've tried to address this in this poem about crossing that invisible line. And it's something I've caught myself doing again and again and again. I'll see something in the news or, you know, on television, and I'll start thinking, oh, what a great poem that would make. And I don't necessarily think about the people that are involved or the gravity of the situation. This is a little black. Oh, and I guess there's only one other thing that might need to be said. I suppose you're aware that people are aware of Juarez, Mexico. Juarez, Mexico is a border city in the United States that for a while now has been in the throes of a huge drug war. And it's one of the most violent places on the planet. And and I had been listening to a story on the radio about how the children in the area were coping with it. And so that was the background of this poem. So when I talk about Juarez, I'm talking about a place where children step over bodies to get to school if they're still being allowed outside, and it's quite dark. This is a little black. The children of Juarez have run out of red crayons. There's so much blood in their eyes. The bodies of mules dumped in their schools, hands and heads by the road, blood in pools, blood in stories of blood. Before I know it, I'm planning my own crime,
the worst a poet can commit. To steal suffering, call it mine. How vivid, I think, what a strong detail on which to build. I open my computer, the great self-making book of our age. Search for more of the story, for the words run out of red crayons. I find children out of red in Pakistan, in Haiti. No red left in Afghanistan, none in Georgia. The children of Sierra Leone have gone through pink to purple. In Myanmar, they're down to brown. I thought I had something to add. I have nothing to add but a little black, the color of the line, color that consumes all others. Thank you, you're very kind. And I never know how to follow that poem. So this is a poem about speechlessness. And it's a poem about when you've got a million things to say and nothing quite gets out. So it's a nocturne, but it's just called Knocked. You said you would what? 1,200 miles in a day. I counted houses, then there came home to an empty, not even my shirt. My green shirt. Are you wearing it now? It's hot. The house is hot. The walls, even the handle on the roof. What can anyone hope to keep? If either of us could answer. Oh. I think I'm on time. A friend of mine said,
nobody's going to remember anything you say, kid, unless you go over. And then we'll be hanging on every word, so.
Keep track of my time here. Okay. There's a sentence in the English language that that I think has certainly crossed the oceans. And my apologies to anyone who's ever been on the receiving end of this one. It's usually uttered in genuine compassion, and it's only later that you think about what it might have actually meant when somebody says, "The last thing I want to do is hurt you." And you think,
"The last thing?"
This is called, "The last thing I want to do is hurt you." The last thing I want to do is hurt you. Before that, my love, long before that, I'd like to learn another language. Maybe Portuguese, though people tell me Hindi and Mandarin are the future, the tongues of men on the moon. Which reminds me, before I hurt you, I want to go to space and float like a wing. What do you think happens to birds in zero gravity? Do they panic or relax? Finally relax. Do they become fish? Someone must know by now, some astro or cosmonaut who said mostly to himself,
"Don't be afraid. I just want to know if you can live without doing what you must. The last thing I want to do is hurt you."
After I see the Grand Canyon, the pyramids of Giza, the little cave at Laverna where St. Francis slept and listened to God and went blind. First, I want to see my home again, my heavy home, the breakable life I already know. I want to have some visions too, angels or ghosts or natural disasters. I want to warn the village. Any village. The dam is breaking, the fire is building, the air is filling with cows. Time to make a list. How mad will you be if you don't swim the 100 seas, don't dive the sky, never go to the cobra show? My love, you can take it out on me. Okay, this is a I'm going to do something really quick. This is going to be a quick lightning round of very tiny poems by authors from back home. This is a tiny poem by a Los Angeles writer named Holly Prado. It's a poem about poetry. It's called The Garden. Rilke has said that each man will take with him from the earth one word he loves best. I've been thinking all day, just in case, and can't go beyond lizard. William Carlos Williams, who just had a birthday. This is called The Hurricane. The tree lay back on the garage roof and stretched. You have your heaven, it said. Go to it. And lastly, this is from the East Coast. This is the New Yorican poet Pedro Pietri. This is called Phone Booth 409. Goes like this. When I was very young, I had many imaginary girlfriends. Now that I'm an adult, I miss them very much. So we'll segue into a love poem. This is what happens when you try to write them with the television on. Oh, Bond.
I don't really need to read this.
My love, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be recorded in my pillow. If you desire, you may request a transcript of every crushed feather. You have that right, too. Knowing and understanding these rights as I sing them, are you willing to answer without a moon present? Put your hands in the air and walk toward me. Tell me what you know.
Okay. All right. How you doing? Hold on,
I don't know what I would have done if you'd said, we're doing very bad.
I don't know how I would have handled that, but how polite to ask. Yeah, we lied.
There we go.
Okay. So, picking up a little bit, this is, I accidentally took a whole bunch of dope for about 26 years. No, for about 12 years. Well, actually, it was an accident. Anyway, I you have well, there was a phrase that I would hear over and over again without really thinking about it. I kept hearing about the war on drugs. The war on drugs. You're part of the war on drugs. You're contributing to the war on drugs. You are the war on drugs. And but it never occurred to me to think of it in terms of, what if the war was the thing that was on drugs? And you may have heard of the country I'm from, America, and we're pretty sure right now that we invented war. And so this draws on a number of themes, but it begins with that initial premise of the war being the thing that's on drugs. This is the war on drugs. The war called at midnight, called again at 2. Third time it left a message, made no sense. Something about wagons, a palm tree, weeping. I played it over, weeping. Said something about money, a ride to the airport. The airport was closed, was falling. The airport was crawling with cops. Come get me, it asked. Can you come get me? But it never said where. It called at sunrise, then again at noon, left a message, half rage, half song. You're all a bunch of cowards! You don't care if I die, I. To hell with all y'all! It must have called someone else after that. Someone who answered. A month passed. I heard it went north. I heard Mexico. A friend of a friend saw it raging in Rome. Now it's here, in this room, with the shades drawn and the lamps on. It won't show me its eyes, its red, red eyes, rubbed out like the price of a gift.
It's wearing a hospital gown over jeans, a house dress over nothing, wearing a helmet, a rifle. It's barefoot, sandaled, got huge black boots with no laces, and it's sorry. It's so sorry about things, the disappearing, the curses and songs. No, really, it wants to surrender. Can it stay, some of it? Can some of it stay the night?
I should keep away from the windows, it says. I should kill the lights.
If I say no, it'll go off. It will cry or break things, accuse me of loving it all wrong. I love it all wrong. As a cup loves coins, a bed loves fire, a tree loves whoever comes to eat its last heart. When the phone rings again, the war watches me hesitate, then grabs the receiver. It doesn't know its own voice on the other end. Christ, it's so loaded. It can't tell it's lying. Okay, it says, I'll ask, but seriously, just for one night. And if I let it stay, it won't stay. That is, it'll find something of mine to steal, then find a reason to leave before more of it comes. In helicopters, rubber rafts, in buses, paper bags, comes to take the city mother by mother and pawn it. What will it get for us?
Very kind, thank you. Thank you very much. Just a couple more, and then I guess we'll hear from the folks in the open mic, which I'm really looking forward to. Okay. One thing I haven't seen too much of on cars out here is bumper stickers. Do you have them? Do you know what I mean? Little stickers that you put on the bumper of the car that have a slogan?
There's many of them here.
No.
But you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, of course.
My neighbor has a Porsche.
Okay, there you go.
My other car is a Porsche.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Okay, this is, this is a little tiny piece called Gravelock, and it's just a series of bumper stickers for coffins.
I
was randomly kind and senselessly beautiful. I loved my dog. I loved my kids. I loved New York. I am the proud parent of a million ants. My other car is the wind. My other car is a field of asphodels. This is my other car. Don't laugh, it's paid for. Don't laugh, I'm ahead of you. Laugh all you want. Okay. All right. Yeah. This is your two poem warning, is that okay? Cool. Did anybody's parents Regina? Did you have bedtime stories? One person got bedtime stories, that was it. The rest of you were neglected, nobody else told their stories. How did they just put you to bed with the lights out? If you have any questions, we'll review them in the morning. But you've heard of, tell me you've heard of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. You know, because this poem is going to die. Otherwise, all right. This is so sad. When did they read them to you? In the morning? What did you...
Read them ourselves.
During dinner.
Before
read them ourselves.
Okay. Well, I guess that's... Wow, really?
Yes.
That's so sad. Just sitting up in bed and reading your, and then you with a hand mirror, and then you told yourself to go to sleep. I'm very sorry. Well, I'll greet you later on and before you go to bed.
And thank
you. So this is a tiny little poem, and I've numbered the pages for the intellectual. What happened to the poem? It's in here. Oh, here we go. Okay. This is a little poem called My Favorite Story Is This One. Actually, I do know it. My favorite story is this one.
where a little blonde girl attacks a family of bears, trashes their home, eats their food, then runs away feeling invaded. My favorite part comes after the end, when the father bear wordlessly repairs a little chair, a nail held in his black lip. The mother bear wipes a table with a checkered rag, and the cub cries his eyes at a window, watchful ever after for a golden anyone. So this is my last poem, and it does need an introduction, just because I want to tell you a little bit about a project I'm working on. It's the title poem of a new book that's coming out in 2016. I get to work with this project called the Alzheimer's Poetry Project, and it really is poetry workshops for people dealing with dementia. And this is much easier work than you might think. There's a thing called the Alzheimer's Poetry Project. There's a big, helpful website, and they pretty much give you everything that you would need to know to walk into an elder care center and begin to share poetry with people that are in various stages of dementia and senility and Alzheimer's. And I was doing it for a while, and I started to notice this very curious thing. You seem to actually be able to watch memory sort of fall apart and pull itself back together. The more I worked with these people, I found that there was this, and I don't mean to be brash about it, but it really did seem to exemplify a thing that T.S. Eliot talked about in the Four Quartets, where he says, "It seems as one becomes older that the past has a different order and ceases to be a mere sequence." Now, you don't have to be dealing with dementia to have that experience, but it did seem to be a pattern that I saw over and over and again. And I wanted to write about it, but like I was talking about, I was very careful. I was worried about crossing a line into appropriation and writing about something that was not mine to discuss. And then my mother surprised me by telling me that she was nervous about dementia. She was worried that it was going to manifest. And she told me how she wanted me to handle it. She told me what she wanted me to do if it occurred. And I realized the words she used were my way into the poem that I wanted to write. That in fact, if I just started with only the words that she used, that I could write a poem that would start to fall apart and pull itself back together using only the words that she used. And so this poem is going to fall apart and pull itself back together and fall apart and pull itself back together. Again, it's my last piece. I thank you very much for your attention and your example. I look forward to your work tonight. This is Dementia, My Darling. If someone finds me on the road, if someone finds me on the road in my nightgown, barefoot and talking, in my nightgown, barefoot and talking, if my talking nightgown finds the road in me and someone on barefoot, or I'm throwing my money to the cars, or I'm throwing my money to the cars, convinced I'm just feeding the ducks. Convinced I'm just feeding the ducks. I'm feeding the money, the cars, or the ducks. I'm just convinced to throwing. Please lock me away. Please lock me away and live your life. And live your life. And lock your life away. Please live me. If my talking convinced someone, my barefoot lock on the road, ducks in the cars throwing money to live, and the feeding finds me, and I'm me, or I'm your life, please just nightgown away. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was the amazing Brendan Constantine. Big round of applause.